third day of the trial of a former U.S. officer charged with the murder of African-American George Floyd features a devastating footage and an emotional testimony. Campaigners stamp as a whitewash a British government report on racial disparities that denies the existence of institutional racism in the UK. Also ahead, Lebanon's Hezbollah leader calls for the immediate formation of a new Lebanese government to end the political crisis in the country. Welcome to World News, live from Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Now, new footage is displayed during the third day of the trial of a former Minneapolis officer charged with the murder of George Floyd, which shows the black man pleading for mercy.
I'm a bad guy, man.
In the car.
I'm not a bad guy. Please, take a seat.
The video was captured by an officer's body-worn camera who was trying to apprehend Floyd. The footage was shown while prosecutors were questioning eyewitnesses. The witnesses included a cashier who received a counterfeit $20 bill from Floyd, an event that prompted the officers to make the arrest. The cashier said he believed Floyd didn't know the bill was fake. The harrowing videos caused one witness to break down in tears during his testimony.
I'm a bad guy, man.
In the car.
I'm not a bad guy.
The witness was reacting to footage that showed Floyd calling for his mother. The former policeman on trial is Derek Chauvin, who kneeled on Floyd's neck for just shy of 9 minutes. He's charged with manslaughter and murder charges. The black man's death sent shockwaves across the U.S., provoking an outcry against racial injustice in the country. U.S. civil rights activist Life Malcolm believes George Floyd's murder trial can never be a remedy for African Americans who have been the main victim of police brutality and racism in America.
Right now, the government has to respond by using Derek Chauvin as some kind of scapegoat. But we know, African people and other people who stand on the side of oppressed people know that there's nothing that the government can't do to Derek Chauvin, even if they do find him guilty, that is going to rectify and remedy the oppression that African people have endured in this country. George Floyd's murder on May 25th of 2020 is just one example of the brutality that African people in this country face all the time. And make no mistake about it, the only reason why this is a big media scandal is not because the white people in the form of the police killed, white power in the form of the police killed an African. It's because he got caught on camera. And so he has to pay for, Derek Chauvin has to pay for being sloppy enough to get caught doing this type of thing that white power does to African people in this country all the time. So they're going to try to use him as a scapegoat, but there's no remedy other than overturning the colonial oppression that we have in this country. It's going to take African people to do it. The United States government cannot redeem itself.
The U.S. Department of Justice has opened a probe into allegations of sexual misconduct against a Florida Republican lawmaker. House Representative Matt Gaetz stands accused of having had a sexual relationship with a minor. Gaetz, an avid supporter of former U.S. President Donald Trump, has dismissed the allegations, calling them plans to extort him and his family. Although no charges have been brought against him as of yet, House Democrats have called for Gaetz's removal from the Judiciary Committee. The probe is part of a wider investigation into sex trafficking against another Florida politician, Joel Greenberg. Elsewhere, Brazil has reported nearly 3,900 daily coronavirus deaths, setting another record for virus fatalities. The figure takes the overall tally to more than 321,000. The health ministry said more than 90,000 cases were also registered in the span of 24 hours. The official tally of infections in the Latin American country has crossed 12.7 million. Brazil recorded more than 66,500 fatalities in March, the country's deadliest month yet in the pandemic. The Latin American country is the second worst hit nation in the world, after the United States in terms of both deaths and infections. The French president has ordered a third national lockdown as the country struggles to contain a new wave of the coronavirus pandemic.
The rules that are now in place in 19 departments in reinforced vigilance will be extended to all metropolitan areas from Saturday evening for 4 weeks.
In his televised address to the nation, Macron said schools would also close for the next 3 weeks after this weekend. He warned that the country risks losing control over the virus. Movement restrictions have already been in place for more than a week in the capital, Paris, and some northern and southern regions. New infections in France have doubled since February to an average of 40,000 a day, with the total death toll nearing 100,000. The surge has threatened to overwhelm hospitals, while the country's vaccine rollout has also been slower than planned. Our Paris correspondent Chris de Horn says many people do not trust the French government's handling of the pandemic, including the vaccination campaign.
The main reason for this new third lockdown, full lockdown, nationwide lockdown all over France for the following 4 weeks is that Macron himself, he said that this virus is a risk to get out of control. So you have 40,000 daily contaminations due to the, especially to the English variant. This is almost double than 2 or 3 months ago. You also have an average of 300 deaths every day due to the coronavirus. The vaccination campaign has been very slow, one of the slowest in all the European Union countries, but the last weeks it's slowly accelerating. So more and more people are getting their vaccines, and they start with the old people and they are going down slowly to younger and younger people. So the aim is to get everybody vaccinated end of June, but that's still an aim. And to be honest, many people do not trust the French government anymore, but to be honest, the vaccination campaign accelerated the last weeks, so more and more people are still getting vaccinated.
Staying in the region, a report has found that an increasing number of Italians are struggling to cope with the financial impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. Many are still struggling even to pay their rent. Max Cervilli has more from Rome.
A new report on household debt by the Bank of Italy has highlighted that some 40% of Italian households are struggling to pay the rent amid economic difficulties linked to the effects of the coronavirus pandemic. According to the report, a large number of indebted families, 3 out of 10, and individuals, 4 out of 10, have said they are having trouble keeping up the payment of their rents or mortgage installments.
The work situation has worsened significantly, particularly for those who had a casual part-time job. For many, it's hard even to make ends meet. Bear in mind that pupils were forced to follow their classes online up to last week, and also for this reason, families have been under huge pressure.
Besides the economic impact of COVID restrictions, there are increasing concerns regarding the obvious effects on people's mental health. Many simply cannot see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Not long ago, the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, warned that some 5.6 million people were recorded as living in absolute poverty in Italy in 2020, an increase of about 1 million over the previous year. About 300,000 small and mid-sized firms that are especially vulnerable to the business disruptions inflicted by the pandemic have gone bankrupt.
Italy was in dire financial straits before the COVID-19 pandemic struck. It was the only G7 country not to have seen its economic growth return to pre-2007 levels after the global financial crisis, and its per capita income is the same as 23 years ago.
The health minister said all non-essential shops will stay closed for the entire month of April, even if the situation rolls back to normal. We disagreed with this approach. Shop must reopen. Italian must get back to work.
Meanwhile, a solidarity initiative to support poor families hit by the pandemic has been officially launched by the National Farmers Association Coldiretti. At least 20,000 households struggling in the middle of the pandemic will be receiving high-quality food products to ensure good meals during Easter festivities. Max Civili, Rome.
Now, British rights activists had described as a whitewash a much-anticipated government report on inequality that denies the existence of institutional racism in the United Kingdom. The report says racism persists in Britain, but the country is not institutionally racist. The document concludes the UK could be regarded as a model for other white-majority countries, but campaigners argue that the report has ignored broad-based evidence pointing to pervasive structural racism. Critics say the report does not account for various measures of racial inequality, from higher rates of imprisonment to poverty and mortality rates for ethnic minorities. The government commission that drew up the report was created in the wake of Black Lives Matter protests last year. The protests followed the police killing of African American George Floyd in Minneapolis. Basil Shachara with the Islamic Human Rights Commission says institutional racism is becoming more and more pervasive in the UK.
It really is a whitewash. I mean, the fact of the matter is, we know that racism has become really institutionalized when it's denied on this sort of level by those who are appointed by the government to sort of highlight and expose the level of racism. Now, to do this at such a time, it really is it's totally unacceptable. The reality is that you look at the sort of the legal system, more people from the black and ethnic minority get arrested for the same charges or same accusations that the white will not get arrested. Then they get more of, when they go to court, they're more likely to find guilty, and they're more likely to be imprisonment, which result in criminalization of the black and ethnic minority. You look at the stop and search, again, it really is, the evidence is very clear that disproportionality is extremely alarming. And, you know, look at employment, housing, in every level, there is institutional racism, and unfortunately is not getting better, is getting much worse.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has called on Saudi Arabia to end its war on Yemen, which has left thousands of civilians dead and most of the impoverished nation's infrastructure in ruin. Mariam Saleh is in Beirut.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, Said Hassan Nasrallah, urged Saudi Arabia to immediately end its war on Yemen and lift its blockade on its southern neighbor. Said Nasrallah called on Saudi Arabia not to waste time by proposing deceiving initiatives which lead to nowhere, and stressed that stopping the war and the blockade should be simultaneous. Nasrallah also warned of a Saudi plot to blame Yemen's Ansarullah movement for the ongoing conflict in the war-torn country.
You need to stop the war and end the blockade. Then we can sit and negotiate. Here's where the deception lies. What does it mean if you stop the war without ending the blockade? It means that what they could not realize through a military war, they want to achieve through humanitarian and social pressure.
Elsewhere in his remarks, he said the U.S. is not as strong as before and is on a path toward collapse, while the axis of resistance is gaining power.
America is no longer the America that you knew. There is one main issue that Imam Khamenei has stressed in the last year, and I call on everyone in the region to ponder on that thought. That is the decline of the U.S. America is taking the downward path.
Speaking at an event commemorating late Sheikh Ahmad al-Zin, who was a pioneer in clerics who spoke for Palestine, Nasrallah stressed that the so-called deal of the century has died as a result of the Palestinian people's patience. Observers believe Sayyid Nasrallah's view shows that there is an opportunity for the entire region, even for the Saudis, to be able to stop the crisis of the war they launched on Yemen.
The speech of Sayyid Hassan shows that all regional sides enjoy an opportunity to hold on to their principles and at the same time preserve their achievements. This is true even with the issue of Islamic Republic of Iran and its nuclear program. All of these developments can pave the way for achieving political results.
Hezbollah leader also warned regional countries against relying on the United States. Hezbollah's leader then touched upon the political impasse in Lebanon, calling for the immediate formation of a new government. Hezbollah Secretary General has stressed in his speech that most of the wars in the region, namely in Syria or Yemen, are mainly aimed to target the resistance and the Palestinian cause and to create a Sunni-Shiite rift. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Turning to other news now, the United Nations says more than 5,000 people fleeing an attack claimed by Daesh-linked terrorists in northern Mozambique have made their way to safety. Thousands also remain missing after the raid on the coastal town of Palma last week. The town is located near gas projects worth $60 billion. Armed militants ransacked buildings and beheaded residents, forcing many to flee. Many of those running away are believed to have scattered into dense nearby forests or attempted to escape by boat. Mozambique's government has only confirmed dozens of deaths. The country's defense ministry has deployed troops to Palma as fighting still continues. The trial of the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Seksaki, has continued in the northern Nigerian town of Kaduna. Danjuma Abdullahi has details of the case.
The prosecution in Sheikh Zazaki's trial finally completed the presentation of witnesses when the trial resumed in a Kaduna High Court, where the Islamic cleric is standing trial for culpable homicide and other charges, which he pleaded not guilty. The prosecution lawyer expressed the hope that he will get a conviction following the presentation of credible witnesses.
We presented about 15 witnesses for the prosecution. 15 top army generals that were key actors, key players in the whole of the saga that led to the filing of the charges against Malam Sheikh Zakzaki. One of our prayers is that the court should overrule the no-case submission, overrule the defense, and convict the defendants accordingly and pass the necessary sentence as provided for.
However, Zazaki's defense team dismissed the claim of the prosecution as it affirmed an earlier position that there shouldn't even have been a case against the Islamic cleric.
So far, based on the evidence advanced thus far, all the 15 witnesses so far, in our estimation, has not made any submission or given any evidence that incriminates the defendant in any manner whatsoever. So it's on that basis that we will be entering the no-case submission.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat have been in detention for over 5 years despite the ruling of a federal high court ordering for their release. Over 340 of Sheikh Zazaki's supporters were killed, including three of his biological sons, when soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked his home and worship center in December 2015. Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat are detained in the Kaduna Correctional Facility, not far from this courthouse where the trial is taking place. Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki has just turned 70, and his supporters are calling for his immediate and unconditional release. Danjuma Abdullahi, Kaduna.
The United Nations has warned of a civil war and imminent bloodbath in Myanmar as the military crackdown on anti-coup protesters has left more than 500 people dead since February. UN envoy for Myanmar, Christine Schreiner-Bergener, called on the Security Council to use all available tools to take collective action and prevent a multidimensional catastrophe. Bergener also said she remained open to dialogue with Myanmar's military junta, warning that the situation will only worsen if the UN waits for when they are ready to talk. Myanmar has been the scene of demonstrations since the military toppled and detained elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The army said the November 2020 elections won by Suu Kyi's party were fraudulent. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
1 year after the COVID-19 pandemic began, U.S. billionaires have made out like gangbusters at the expense of workers, says Chuck Collins, author, in an article published under the heading 10 Biggest Pandemic Profiteers. Stay tuned for the details, please. A year ago, the Institute for Policy Studies published Billionaire Bonanza 2020, Wealth, Windfalls, Tumbling Taxes, and Pandemic Profiteers, and began tracking billionaire wealth gains as unemployment surged across the U.S. A recent report summarizes the extraordinary growth in wealth of those now 657 billionaires based on real-time data from Forbes on March 18, 2021. Here are highlights from the last 12 months of billionaire wealth growth. The combined wealth of the U.S. 657 billionaires increased more than $1.3 trillion, or 44.6%, since the pandemic lockdowns began. Over those same 12 months, more than 29 million Americans contracted the virus, and more than 535,000 died from it. As billionaire wealth soared over almost 80 million lost work between March 21st, 2020 and February 20th, 2021, and 80 million were collecting unemployment on February 27th, 2021. There are 43 newly minted billionaires since the beginning of the pandemic, when there were 614. A number of new billionaires joined the list after initial public offerings of the stock in companies such as Airbnb, DoorDash, and Snowflake. The increase in the combined wealth of the 15 billionaires with the greatest growth in the absolute wealth was $563 billion, or 82%. The wealth growth of just these 15 represents over 40% of the wealth growth among all billionaires. Topping the list are Elon Musk, that is $137.5 billion richer, that is about 559%. Jeff Bezos, $65 billion, that is about 58%. And Mark Zuckerberg, $47 billion, that is about 86%. The 10 biggest pandemic profiteers saw the greatest percentage increase in their wealth, at least 300%. They mostly multiplied their fortunes in the world of online goods, services, and entertainment, as forcibly homebound Americans shopped, invested, and diverted themselves in isolation. They include the owners of e-commerce leaders Kitchen Loans, Square, Carvana, and cryptocurrency exchange Coinbase, social media sites Snapchat and Twitter, online streaming platform Roku, and digital ad agency Trade Desk. 19 other billionaires experienced increases of over 200%, while 48 others more than doubled their fortunes with more than 100% gains. Bum Kim, 670%, that is about $7.7 billion, a U.S. citizen and founder of the e-commerce giant Coupang, the Amazon of South Korea. Kim's fortune surged as high as $11 billion after the company's IPO in early March. And Dan Gilbert, 642%, that is about $41.7 billion, owner of Quicken Loans, which capitalize on cloistered citizens tapping online financing, lives in Michigan. Ernest Garcia II, 567%, that is about $13.6 billion. Biggest shareholder of Carvana, the online car sales and auto financing giant, Arizona. Then there is the Elon Musk, 559%, that is about $137.5 billion. Musk is now the second wealthiest American at nearly $138 billion as his shares in Tesla, SpaceX, and other companies that he owns continue to climb. He lives in Texas. And there is the Brian Armstrong, 550%, $5.5 billion. Chief executive of Coinbase, the largest cryptocurrency exchange in the country. He lives in California. And then there is the Bobby Morphy, that is about 531%. That is $10.1 billion. He is the co-founder of Snapchat with his Stanford fraternity brother, Ivan Spiegel. He lives in California. And Ivan Spiegel, 490%, that is about $4.3 billion. He is the co-founder of Snapchat with his other billionaire super gainer, Bobby Morphy, California resident. And Jack Dorsey, 396%, that is about $10.3 billion, co-founder and CEOs of both Twitter and Square. The small business payment app lives in California. And Tony Wood, 331%, that is about $5.3 billion, founder of Roku, which enables online TV video streaming, California resident. And the 10th, Jeff Green, 300%, that is about $3 billion, Californian founder and chairman of the Trade Desk, a digital advertising firm. Of the industry categories, billionaires in the technology industry had the greatest collective wealth growth, $564 billion or nearly 68%. They were worth $1.4 trillion on March 18, 2021, or one-third of the billionaires' total. The titans of Wall Street, the finance and investment industry, saw their wealth grow by $226 billion, a nearly 37% increase. Automotive industry billionaires had the biggest percentage point increase in wealth, 317%, based on an increase in wealth of $172 billion. That was largely driven by the extraordinary rise in Elon Musk's wealth, that is about $137.5 billion or 559%. All but three states saw the wealth of their billionaire residents increase. Topping the list in total wealth growth are California at $551 billion, Washington at $134.6 billion, and New York at $11.4 billion. The top three states with the greatest percentage increase in wealth are Michigan at 164%, Arizona at 110%, and Hawaii at 107%.
billionaire wealth growth is calculated between March 18, 2020 and March 18, 2021, based on Forbes data compiled in this report by ATF and IPS. March 18 is used as the unofficial beginning of the crisis because they then most federal and state economic restrictions responding to the virus were in place. March 18 was also the date that Forbes picked to measure billionaire wealth for the 2020 edition of its annual Billionaires Report, which provided a baseline that ATF and IPS compare periodically with real-time data from the Forbes website. PolitiFact has favorably reviewed this methodology.
Allama Hassanzada Amouli is not only actually a philosopher, but a very comprehensive scholar that we have. And he is amazingly expert in many different fields of Islamic studies, and not only Islamic studies, but also different branches of sciences, for example, mathematics.
We always need a teacher, and especially in the field of mysticism, you cannot obviously grow unless until you have a teacher. So we definitely need a teacher. Mm-hmm. And the way he had his own teachers, the way he remembered his teachers, and the way he talks about his teachers obviously shows that the role of teacher was very important in his life.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program, The Teacher, which is an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, and jurists all across the nation of Islam. Namely, for this episode, we want to talk about Ayatollah Allameh Hassan Hassanzadeh Amouli. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Dr. Reza Zadeh. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Dr. Reza Zadeh, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, in the opinions of some scholars and some ulama like Ayatollah Hassanzadeh Amouli, Irfan or Islamic mysticism has a significant position.
Mm-hmm.
So, why Irfan for them is important, and what is the general look at the concept of Irfan, Dr. Reza Zadeh?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, for many people and many scholars, Irfan, as it is translated as mysticism, is the most important thing in the world. Why? Because it is the direct experience of the ultimate entity, of the ultimate, let's say.
Okay.
Or direct knowledge of the ultimate. That is the ultimate and the true meaning of Irfan.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we have different types of knowledges. One type of knowledge is called acquired knowledge, ilme husuli.
That's right.
The other type of knowledge is intuitional knowledge that comes from within.
Mm-hmm.
Irfan is a type of, I mean, it, in its true meaning.
Is it shuhudi or qarizi, intuitional?
Intuitional means something that comes from within.
No, in the
shuhudi.
Shuhudi, right.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's like a vision. Uh-huh. So Irfan, in its true meaning, is like a type of knowledge that comes from within.
That's right.
It needs acquired knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But when Irfan, I mean, in its shuhudi meaning, its
yes.
intuitional
okay.
meaning happens,
mm-hmm.
it comes from within. It needs requirements.
So in the acquired sense of the Irfan, we can say we learn something, isn't it? Out of the resources.
We cannot say acquired type sense of Irfan. Irfan is something, the true meaning of Irfan is an intuitional knowledge.
Oh, it is intuitional.
Yes, it is
okay.
intuitional. Yeah, it needs acquired knowledge.
Okay.
But acquired knowledge
uh-huh.
and different and
right.
let's say spiritual practices
oh.
lead to a knowledge.
So it needs a kind of
yeah. it's a
self,
product.
It's a product of self-growth and self-spiritual perfection.
That is the true Irfan. You know, it's the product of self-purification, purification of the soul, a lot of spiritual experiences, and a lot of acquired knowledge.
That's right.
And as a result of all of those different factors, something starts growing from within, a type of knowledge that you gain something and you understand something from inside.
That's right.
And that is
the resemblance to the light inside.
Exactly. Light from within. You know, that is one major meaning of Irfan.
Okay.
And also it has different other aspects and different types.
Okay, we'll get to the types. But Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, this Irfan, let's use the Irfan in this program, not mysticism, because mysticism in the Hinduism and the other branches of the theological and philosophical thought have different meaning. This Irfan, so according to Ayatollah Hassan Zada Amali, must be in complete line and harmony with the Holy Quran and the pure Muhammadan Islam, isn't it? And if it's not, it would be deviated.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, when he says that the philosophy is the Quran, and the Quran is just a philosophy, and we can refer the science of philosophy to Quran, then obviously he is definitely referring Irfan to be the Quranic teachings.
Okay.
And one cannot attain or one cannot get the ma'rifah of the Haqq. Obviously, he had many books. One of his books is Annahul Haqq.
That's right.
In which he has talked about the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and who is Haqq and how we should know God.
Yes.
There he has the same, this discussion, the Quranic discussion. Also, he has another book in which he is talking about the man and Irfan. In that also, he's defining the man in the eyes of Quran, obviously.
That's right.
And for him, everything is Quran and the teachings of Ahlul Bayt.
That's right.
Why? Because
are two all of them. Books.
Even with the names of these books, we can imagine what kind of we can say
Irfan is he after.
Or Irfan he is following.
Right. Okay.
So basically, when we look at the books of the Allama Hasan Zade Amri or his lectures, his ideas or his we can say like the thesis that he had, the articles that he wrote, all of them are on the same level. We can say all of them are matched with the Quran and
that's
its
right.
According to the Quranic teaching. The interesting point is that because he makes Quran as a core, and he says like the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the Quran, obviously these are the main core, and Ahlul Bayt are the interpreters of the Quran.
That's right.
That if someone wants to get to the Irfan, he has to obviously follow the teachings of Ahlul Bayt.
That's right.
And then he says that the Irfan itself means that anything that is taking human to the perfection, or human making, the maker of human as a human. You know, when we talk about the human, we talk about the human rights, humanity.
That's right.
The knowledge or ma'rifah that takes you towards the humanity is the real Irfan.
Okay.
That's how he defines it.
That's all right.
And he says that a person cannot become an arif unless until he believes in Tawheed al-Samadi.
Which is
the Tawheed is obviously the monotheism.
That's right.
And Samadhi is the needless monotheism that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he is one and he is needless.
Okay.
And if we believe in this, then we know that even our existence is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Okay.
So he goes and he opens the different layers of ma'rifah or the knowledge of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, knowing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Okay, that's right. Okay, Dr. Reza Zadeh, so the best type of Irfan is the Irfan which is in line with the Holy Quran and the teachings of Ahlul Bayt. And all of a sudden, if you miss the track and miss this type of track, what would happen to the Arif?
You know, one thing which is a pity is that Irfan, although it is one of the greatest and the most important and the most appealing concepts that we have in the world and one of the most appealing things for the humanity, because of its natural vague, has been interpreted in a way that is absolutely different from what can truly be called mysticism and Irfan.
Okay.
In other words, Irfan by many people has been downgraded to just a set of mere good feelings, and you know, especially for one major example is the new spiritual movement.
Yeah,
you
the
know?
Happiness.
Yes,
the
if
happiness.
You feel good, they call it a type of a spiritual thing or mystical things. But when you go to the deeper and the more authentic sources, you find that mysticism is something much greater than this.
That's
we
right.
cannot downgrade it to just a set of feelings.
Okay.
So
it seems that the modern mystical approaches are still limited to the physical boundaries.
That
but
is one of the problems.
But
yes.
a spirit and the soul scene comes into the scene, and the perfection happens in that realm of
exactly.
the human being. Okay.
You know, they talk about the real human that needs the real salvation, and they have a much more comprehensive look at the human, not only as a physical mortal
yes.
being. So that is one thing. And here it comes the importance of knowing the factors or criteria that makes true Irfan and false Irfan distinct
yes.
from each
yes.
other. So your question can be answered this way.
That's right.
When we come to true mysticism, it has many different criteria.
Mm-hmm.
One is that a true mysticism that is going to give you a true understanding and knowledge of God needs to be in line with religion. Today in the world, we have a lot of examples of mysticisms or mystical movements
yes.
that have nothing to do with religion, and
yes.
some of them are even anti-religion.
Okay.
So
the sad news happens when these, we can say, mysticism. Of course, inside Islam, we have some deviated groups, okay?
Yeah, that is another type of deviation
yes.
that I will talk about.
Yeah.
So
I want to say the sad news happens when they leave all their religious obligations
yes.
and they don't want to
yes.
have
that
spiritual
is,
perfection.
That is another type of deviation.
Okay.
So when we say that the true Irfan needs to have criteria, one is to be in line with aql or intellect.
Mm-hmm.
The other is that it needs to be in line with religion, and it has many different aspects.
That's
For example,
right.
one of the aspects of being in line with religion is not to be in contradiction with religious laws.
That's right.
So when a person claims that
okay.
he is a mystic or
yes.
they are doing Irfan
yes.
or something
yes.
without being committed to the Islamic
mm-hmm.
do's and don'ts,
okay.
that's a sign of being a false Irfan.
They are completely committed to the religious obligations.
Yes.
Thank
so
okay.
religion in general
yes.
and also another factor, just
yes.
mentioned the
okay.
name. Another factor is the real Irfan is a mysticism, is a type of a spirituality which has been made for real life,
mm-hmm.
not for a separated life in the caves.
Yeah.
That like what we
a
have
solitude
in Rahbaniyat,
yeah.
you know, in monasticism in
yes.
some religions.
Yes.
That is not the Irfan that we
okay.
consider
That's right.
true Irfan.
So a true Arif, Sayyid Mohsen, can live among the people, follow the religious laws, and at the same time reach a spiritual perfection, isn't it? This is a comprehensive plan for
it
life.
It is, and Quran always talks about this type of mystics or arif,
mm-hmm.
we can say. Obviously, the other deviations, for example, tasawwuf and the other
yes.
things, or Sufism that
yes.
we have, obviously, they cut from the world.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, the other kinds of mysticism that you very well said that we should not use the word mysticism
yes.
in this program. Let's use
yeah.
the word Irfan.
Irfan.
It's because obviously they were cutting from the world and they were trying to gain the, you know, the ranks or maybe like
yes.
you know, the salvation and all
yes.
those things. But the real Irfan is that you live among the people,
mm-hmm.
the way Ahlul Bayt and the prophets,
yes.
they lived among the people and they were the perfect human beings of their
okay.
time, obviously.
That's right.
And they were the teachers and the role model. Even for the Arafa,
mm-hmm.
they are the role models.
That's all right.
That they lived in this world, they worked, they joined
had families.
The families,
yes.
yes. They were with the families,
yes.
kids and everything.
Yes.
And on top of that, obviously, they were the Arafa. They were the best and
yes.
the perfect Arafa, we can say.
Yes. They were connected to the true knowledge and the ma'rifah
yes.
of Allah. So
and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, obviously,
right.
we have many verses which can be applied on these
okay.
awliya.
That's right.
Which are mentioned in the Quran.
Okay.
This is what it should be, and
okay.
This is the real definition. I
yes.
just remember of a story by Imam Zainul Abidin that a lady who was a Sufi, she came to Imam Zainul Abidin, and she said that I never got married, I never had the kids,
mm-hmm.
and I used to pray to Allah Subhanahu wa Taala, and I got these ranks or the
mm-hmm.
extraordinary, you know,
there are some super or extraordinary things.
Supernatural powers.
Supernatural powers.
That's right.
Sometimes people do get.
Yes.
Imam said, if this is the criteria that you said, that you did not get married and you should be getting away from this world, then Allah wouldn't make Hazrat Fatima Zahra Salamu Alayha as the leader of the women of the world. Sayyidatul Nisa'il Alameen.
That's right.
She had kids, she had husband,
yeah.
She was called as Ummi Abiha,
yes.
And she is at the highest rank of, we can say, like Irfan and the perfection.
Yes.
So that the Prophet, when she enters the room, Prophet used to stand up,
yes,
in her right. respect. So
okay.
It shows that the real Irfan is within the society.
Mm-hmm.
And Allah has created us so that we can live in the society.
That's
because
right.
If a real Arif is living amongst the people, people will learn from him how to go towards the perfection.
And how much committed they are to the family.
You know, this is very important. You know,
yes.
For these people, for mystics like him, like
yes.
him and Allama Tabatabai, and
yes.
other true mystics that we
yes.
have, true Arafa that we have, you know, these examples of the things that may be considered worldly for other people are exactly the opposite. Having wives or kids or living among people and serving other people is the best and the greatest means for getting closer to God for them. Being kind to their wives is a spiritual exercise for them. They are the kindest to their families because that is how they see the presence of God in this world. So
right.
This is how they look at the things, and this is why they are different.
So serving the servants of Allah
yes.
is a blessing.
And also
for
loving
them.
The servants
yes.
of God
okay.
and loving their families and mm-hmm. the kids and everything.
That's right. Okay. And the family.
You know, it's
yeah.
not
and
only
friends.
About the servants of God, it's about the creatures of
creatures.
Yes.
That's right. That's right. They are
everything. You know,
creatures.
The environment around you,
yeah.
the animals. Obviously,
yeah.
today we have all these laws, but these Arafa, the Islam
yes.
always teaches about this. And the basic point about, the main point about Ayatollah Hassan Zadeh Amri, one of his, one of his thoughts that he had in the mysticism or the Irfan,
yes.
is that he says this world in which we are living is the pure goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And the Shar, which is evil, it's relative. Obviously, it is relative to the other person. For example, a snake, it has a poison. But it's for his own protection.
That's right.
A person who tries to get near to him, that is harm for him. It's not that Allah did not create shar or the evil
mm-hmm.
in this world. It's for the protection of the person or its relative
That's right.
to the people. But the whole universe, we can say, he says that it is the pure goodness and nothing else other than goodness.
Okay,
whereas
so Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created the world upon pure goodness.
Yes.
Okay. That's right.
And true mystics see God in everything.
Thank you very much, Dr. Reza Zadeh.
You're very welcome.
And Said Mohsen Naghvi for your presence in the program, The Teacher. Dear listeners, you can visit our website for more information at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam Radio. Also, a YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
New proposals have been made to expand the capacity of the express rail cargo lines between Chinese plants and European nodes, and slash not only time, but also cost, to lure more goods to flow overland from China to Europe. 2020 data from the Suez Canal's operator shows as much as 80% of the trade between Asia and Europe still flows via the Suez Canal. We've prepared for you an article written by Frank Chen under the heading Suez Canal Logjam Boosts China-Europe Rail Link. The article has been published by Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Frank Chen's article. Chinese manufacturers, exporters and shipping firms whose vessels and consignments are still stuck in the logjam of the Suez Canal are scrambling to find detours for their wares. This is despite news on Monday, 29th of March, that the Egyptian operator of the waterway has freed the container ship which ran aground and stymied intercontinental trade flow a week ago. The Evergreen, one of the largest ships of its kind, was fully laden after making a port call at China's Shenzhen port, but became wedged whilst passing through the Suez Canal en route to Rotterdam in the Netherlands. Chinese papers cite shipping agencies and forwarding firms as saying that the 20,000-plus containers the ship carried were stacked full of goods ranging from IKEA furniture to medical supplies, including face masks. The past week saw maritime traffic at both ends of the Suez Canal, a vital 163-kilometer shortcut linking the Mediterranean and the Red Seas, back up in both directions. In the meantime, China Railway Group Cargo Division has seen inquiries and orders surge. Space and pallets on the express rail cargo lines between Chinese plants and European nodes are being filled quicker than ever. A new bonanza, as China and Europe just celebrated the line's 10 years in service since March of 2011. New proposals have been made to expand the capacity of the rail link and slash not only time, but also costs to lure more goods to flow overland from China to Europe. 2020 data from the Suez Canal's operator shows as much as 80% of the trade between Asia and Europe still flows through the Suez Canal. Rail could rest a bigger share of the traffic, with trunk lines now connecting China's industrial powerhouses like Zhejiang and Guangdong to Germany's Hamburg and Duisburg, key rail nodes in the heart of Europe where commodities are forwarded to feeder lines across the European continent. Zhang Ming, the chief of the Chinese mission to the European Union, noted when addressing a virtual event marking the 10th anniversary of the transcontinental rail link that 12,400 trips were made to deliver goods from China to 92 cities scattered across 21 European countries in 2020. The Chinese State Council's National Development and Reform Commission also said streamlined customs inspection and clearing procedures and modernization of trains would mean going overland from Shanghai to Hamburg would save a fourth of the time needed for shipping via Egypt's Suez Canal. The State Council and the Foreign Ministry are among the key advocates of rail cargo and reportedly brushed off state-owned shipping firm COSCO's strong opposition to opening more rail routes between Europe and China. Johannes Pflug, a municipal government official in Duisburg in Germany in charge of foreign business affairs, told China News Service that it would normally take just 2 weeks for Chinese exports to arrive in the city of Duisburg by rail, but they would need to spend as long as a month at sea if key waterways and sea lines of communication become congested or blocked. He also said trains going back to China would also be full with auto parts, drinks and food, as Germany ramped up its efforts to sell more to its largest trading partner, China. The obvious cost-effectiveness is also attracting Chinese exporters of time-sensitive goods and high-technology products, as the average cost per container sent via rail is a fifth of now curtailed air freight services between China and Europe, with many of the flights grounded by the COVID-19 outbreak yet to be reinstated. The group added that rail operations in China and Europe would work together to feed goods back and forth between Europe and China. Meanwhile, Egypt's Suez Canal is likely to take weeks to ease the gridlock, with shipping firms advised to find other routes to avoid the tailback. China's Central Television revealed recently that the average cost of sending goods by rail to Europe was at least 50% higher than sailing via the Suez Canal, and a capacity bottleneck would push the price even higher. Operator with a port rail transshipment company in eastern China's Zhejiang province, where a majority of goods for Europe were being made, told Asia Times that a cargo train could normally haul 200 containers, but the giant evergreen ship alone could carry 100 times that amount. He said Zhejiang province's goods sold to Europe via the multiple rail routes amounted to about 1 million containers last year, a fraction of the total shipments made. The Ningbo Zhushan port in Zhejiang province handled more than 28 million containers in 2020. Beijing's new transportation and infrastructure development plan for the next 5 years, recently approved during recent parliamentary session, sets out projects to extend rail lines further into Central Asia. But the plan also envisions new container berths to be built at key maritime hubs, such as the ports of Shanghai, Ningbo, Guangzhou, and Shenzhen. Piggybacking on China's resilient trade ties with the West, Shanghai and Ningbo have been the world's busiest and third busiest container ports for several years.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.